Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hello, everyone. Sarah here with John and Aiden.
Today, we are going to be talking about the connecting legacy of mentoring the natural mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a lifelong story for me. It is really about starting with one kind of worldview belief system that was handed down to me by my parents, by my peers, by my school, and another worldview that emerged from a thread from my grandmother, who had a strong connection to her Irish culture, and another thread that wove around that thread from my great aunt, who had enough strong culture left from her Polish upbringing as a farmer. They were all, the two families were both farmers and hunters and fishermen. And, you know, so there was a bit of a subsistence mindset there too, and a closeness to the land. And, you know, this mentoring that I received as a young boy from my elders then got me ready for the mentoring that I received from my childhood mentor, who I met when I was 10 in 1971, Tom Brown Jr. And he himself was part of a connecting legacy, a legacy of what he calls coyote teaching, or coyote teaching, as he calls it, which is the way that his elder mentor, who he called grandfather, mentored him. But in really understanding Tom's story, reading his books, working at his school for the last 53 years off and on, being in many, many classes with him, I began to understand and see that this man was aware of things and capable of things that most modern people don't even know exist in a certain sense. And there's a level of expansion of the nervous system into awareness, a level of building relationships with the elements, you know, with the seasons, with day and night, with all the different plants and animals and weather and even the soils and geology. I mean, it's like a woven relationship with the earth that essentially causes a different way of perceiving, a different belief structure emerges. And along, you know, with that different belief structure, which, by the way, is not something that you have to think about. It literally emerges. It feels like it comes from your core. And with that also comes this profound sense of health. You know, you're a lot happier. You're a lot more vital. You have an ability to listen really well unconditionally to other people when they're sharing with you. You develop a strong sense of empathy, which you learned from the trees and the animals and the birds, so to speak, but you bring it into your human relations. And then you have this commitment to want to be helpful to other people, to the earth, to the future generations. It just sort of emerges out of you, an intrinsic drive. And then you start to feel awe, wonder, gratitude from the simplest things. So life stops being boring. You stop being distracted or seeking distraction. You find joy in everyday little things. Then your capacity for love and for understanding, compassion, forgiveness, it grows. And you develop this consistent ability to stay in a mindful state, as modern people might say, because mindfulness would be kind of the closest thing I can get to this. But if you add mindfulness to sensory awareness, where you're really sensing the landscape in all directions and dimensions, if you will, it creates this quietness inside the thought stream. Like the thought stream just relaxes and takes a break. And instead, you're just in this kind of state of wonder, awareness. But that state also opens up this gateway to your own creative juices. You know, you become more visionary, more creative. And these attributes of deep nature connection, you know, these are kind of like the symptoms, if you will. But, you know, like when, for instance, when people meet people in their young 20s that have grown up with this mentoring model, you know, we've taught this mentoring model to many around the world and worked with many of the communities to help foster their leadership and help them emerge into this natural mind. And now, you know, they're working with other people's children, and these children grow up and become young adults, and they show up in a particular way where the parents of children who are of a similar age make remarks like this: oh, we thought we did everything right with our children, but they're experiencing anxiety and other issues and, you know, self-doubt, and they're stressed about their lives and about the future. But these people who are the same age as my children, they're such wholesome, lovely human beings. And I want to know what you're doing. How did you get that to happen for these people? You know? And that's what I mean by mentoring the natural mind. It's a bit nuanced. It's layered. There's not like I could give you a book called Coyote's Guide to Connecting with Nature, right? That's filled with, you know, the tools and tips and principles of how to do this. But the actual embodied skill of it, you know, takes a little while to actually to get. And I would say that maybe the most important thing on the way to attaining those mentoring skills is actually developing those attributes yourself. You become embodied in your connection. You experience that worldview shift, which becomes much more about how much we all depend on each other, how we need to all work together, how we need to take care of each other and the earth and the future generations, right? There's something bigger than us that's moving through this world. The ways we are being as human beings on this planet aren't serving us anymore. And, you know, they're causing a lot of side effects that are destructive. And I want to be part of the solution, you know, and I'm going to figure out a way. This kind of mindset, you know, if it could take root and gain critical mass in the human population, I think it would really shift the impact that we're having on each other and on this earth in a positive direction. Having seen it happen in so many little communities, you know, little microcosmic examples from individuals and families and communities around the world who have been doing this wonderful mentoring. I believe, you know, the pattern language speaks for itself. It's like, yeah, there's measurable differences. These people are hopeful. You know, they're not struggling with mental illness. They're not struggling with a sense of isolation or, you know, sense of loneliness. You know, they feel very connected to their place. They feel connected to the people that they're, you know, that they share their life with. You know, they feel meaning in their work, in their world, you know, and that sort of thing. So, you know, this is sort of a long definition of mentoring, that legacy of connection. It's like, you know, because grandfather was mentored in that way since he was a boy, and he mentored Tom since he was a boy, and my grandmothers and Tom mentored me since I was a boy, I naturally want to do that for others. But, you know, my last 40 years, I've been reverse engineering. Well, what is it? And can we share it? And can we scale it? You know, so that's what I live for, essentially.
Thank you, John. So the connecting legacy of mentoring the natural mind, and I heard you speak to the attributes of connection, like joy and vitality and caretaking others, and describe how these come out of mentoring in a connective way. I have two questions. First is the natural mind, what you're describing here as the emergence of these attributes. And my second question is, what is the role of nature? Does it have to be nature, or is it, you know, mentoring in any context?
The answer to the first question, you know, are these attributes of connection analogous to the natural mind? You know, I would say that they are externally visible qualities in another person. So, you know, as a mentor who's working to help foster the natural mind in another person, I know I've reached my goal when they have those attributes. But the other thing that would have to be said and looked at is, when you are the person who is experiencing the natural mind, how does that change your view of life, in a sense? How does it shift your state of awareness, your consciousness, which I think is also really interesting and worth exploring? And does it have to be nature, or could it be anything? It's kind of like a Venn diagram. You know, effective mentoring is a pretty consistent set of principles, you know, and whether you're doing mentoring within music, like Aiden does, or you're mentoring within, you know, say sports, you know, if you're a coach or something and you're working with a soccer team, or you're working one-on-one with an athlete and you're trying to help them develop their skills in their particular sport, mentoring is going to be following similar patterns. And that is that, you know, as a mentor, you're not there to impart your knowledge upon your student. You know, it's not like I am an expert and you, student, must learn from me. It's quite different. In what mentoring is doing is the mentor is trying to inspire and motivate. But the mentor, if they're good, a mentor is really studying their student with all of their awareness. You know, they're really tracking that student. You know, what does that student love? What does that student hate? What does that student fear? What does that student think is really funny? What do they think is sad? You know, what are the things that motivate and drive this individual? And right now, and I mean right now in this moment, as this student is before me, what is it that they're working on right now? And what is their need? You know, what is their edge? So if they're right now super curious about, you know, being able to play scales, that, well, that's where they're at right now. And maybe as a music teacher, I would have shown up and thought, well, today we're going to learn chords and we're going to play with a metronome some chords. But we kind of ignore the student because he or she really wants to learn scales. And that's what they're super passionate about. It's like you want to meet them in their place where they're passionate and help grow that and draw it out. And if you, as the mentor, feel that they also need chords and, you know, they need to work on their timing, well, you find a way to work them in that direction through the passion of scales. You know, and I'm using the music metaphor because people wouldn't maybe relate as easily to the nature metaphors that I might use if I was doing natural mind mentoring. As a mentor, you know, we are drawing out the light in the other. We're not acting as an expert and teaching them something or passing on a recipe. There is teaching involved in mentoring from time to time. For instance, when I've mentored a person, I will use an example here. You know, they're having a difficult time telling the difference between a red fox track and a house dog track that is a similar size. As a mentor, I'm going to get them to study and tell me what they see in both of those tracks. You know, tell me about this track over here, which is the fox track. And I won't say that's a fox track. So tell me about it. Instead, I'll say, tell me about what you see in this track. And they'll describe everything they're seeing. And when they're done describing everything they're seeing, I would say, what about this? Do you see this right here? And I might point to the heel pad there that has this little bar across it. Do you see that right there? What do you see? Oh, yeah, I see kind of like a gently curved line that sticks out. And what about these over here? You see them around all the toes? What is that? Oh, that looks like it came from hair. I'm like, okay, good. Now let's look at the other one, right? And then they look at the other one and they, oh, yeah, I don't see that hair and I don't see that bar. And, oh, yeah, these toes seem fatter. Even though the track is roughly the same size, the toes seem fatter. There's something different about the way this foot is striking the ground. This one seems to be lighter over here, and that would be the fox tracks they're pointing to. This one seems to be squishing in deeper, like it's a heavier animal, and that's the house dog. I'm like, okay, good. Now that they've done that work and I've drawn that through their senses and out of them, at this point, I might show them in the field guide the difference between a red fox track and a dog track, because as the mentor, I drew them in, drew them past their edge, their blind spots. They weren't seeing the bar and the hairs at first, right? But once they learn to see the hairs and that bar in the track for the fox, they can't unsee it. It's like they've now trained their perception to see it every time it's there. You know, it's like you've opened up a portal for perception for them. But they have to do the work. And as the mentor, you draw them through their senses to experience that. And that opens up this connection and relationship with, you know, their senses and makes it a little bit more potent. You know, mentoring has that in common no matter what subject. You know, we're drawing people through and out. You know, we're not making them do the work. We're trying to inspire and motivate them to be interested in the work, and that it has to start from motivation and it has to start from inspiration if it's internally driven on their part. The more we can get them to work that cycle of, you know, I'm inspired and motivated to look at these things before me or listen to these sounds around me or experience this skill or this activity, you know, the more we can get them to go through that, catch their stories, ask them good questions, and then re-inspire them with more stories and deeper questions, then they go around that cycle again. The more they go around that cycle, they become more and more self-motivated. They become more and more driven and passionate to follow the mysteries of their life on their own, you know, they become really good researchers and really reflective people who are committed to a learning and a holistic experience journey. You know, they just become hungry for it. It just gives them so much joy. So that's, you know, that's mentoring. Okay. You know, mentoring in music only, or mentoring in, say, mathematics only, will not have the same effect on our consciousness as mentoring in nature. So can you get the natural mind through any mentoring? I mean, I think you can build a good foundation for it through any mentoring, you know, as long as you're mentoring. And then when you bring in nature to it, nature seems to have gifts to human consciousness that nothing else does. And I believe it has to do with the, well, sheer diversity of nature, number one. Number two, all the different wonderful avenues for passionate study that exists there, you know, whether it's bird language or tracking or self-sufficiency skills, you know, ancestral skills, as you might call them, or survival skills, tending the wild, you know, helping regenerate native landscapes, field ecology, studying, you know, the health of marine ecosystems and ecology, like, you know, having to go underwater with a mask and a snorkel and to be immersed in this other world to experience these life forms. We begin to, we receive gifts from nature in a mentoring setting that we won't receive anywhere else. Nature provides so much wonder, so much awe, the, you know, beautiful sunsets, night skies with, you know, a shooting star or a beautiful bright planet against a dark field of night with the star, you know, the stars lightly twinkling around it. There's so many things in nature that just wake us up to these levels of awe and wonder that just feed our positive emotions and make us feel really happy to be alive. You know, I've never seen anything work like that on people like nature can.
So I'm hearing what you're saying about nature's capacity to take us to a place that other disciplines can't necessarily take us, that mentoring in and of itself is really helpful for development, but it sort of has a ceiling on it without nature. And it reminds me of this quote from David Abram. And he says, "We are human only in connection and conviviality with that which is not human." And he defines the word conviviality as living together, right? Living in connection or experiencing life together. And I think, to me, that really highlights a major difference here. You know, I think about music, and music is, in a way, it is not human, right? There is something there about music that goes beyond human, but our sort of culture around music, the style of music we might want to play, the lyrics that might come along with the song, or all of these things, those are undoubtedly very human. And so it's, we come back into it and we might be learning very deeply, but we are inevitably sort of running into our own culture, our own experience, and ultimately like a reflection of ourselves. But when you go out into nature and you experience the fox or the towhee or the redwood tree or the sunset, you are coming up against the other side of reality, beyond the edge of what it is to be human. And I think that experience takes us somewhere that no human-created or human-centered experience can take us.
Yes, I totally feel that, and really appreciate that quote from David. And it makes me come back to a very sort of everyday example that I think people can relate to here. So I have a friend who recently got a dog. And before that, he didn't have a dog, okay? And he had a particular pattern going in his life, a little bit lonely or a little bit housebound, you know, not getting a lot of exercise or whatever. And this dog enters his life, and I watched him over the course of a couple of weeks really change in the way that he was presenting. He was much happier. He was much more open-hearted. He'd been getting more walks because the dog was, you know, we think we're taking our dog for a walk, but I think the dog might be taking us for a walk sometimes, you know, and there's something else that's going on there. There's like a brightness of relationship that is now detectable in this human being who is now a dog person, right? They had a certain dimensionality to them. And when this dog entered their life and this relationship built, the happiness, the joy, the vitality, like some of these attributes of connection were already showing up in this individual. And it was as if the dog was bringing something extra to this man's consciousness, to his presence, to his state of being. And he totally acknowledges that. He's like, absolutely. You know, this dog has really been a gift. So just think about that, because I think everyone can relate to that. You know, there's this field in, you know, neuroscience psychology that talks about extended cognition, you know, that we, our minds, like when we get together on a team of, you know, two or three people that work really well together, it's almost like I, as one of the members of the team who's thinking creatively in a project endeavor, suddenly I'm capable of thinking about things that I wasn't before you showed up and sat on this team with me and before this other person came and sat on this team with me. It's like we're helping each other. We're loaning each other pieces of our shared nervous system. You know, so if you take that out into nature, so first think of the dog example I just gave. You know, what if the towhee does that for us too, just like the dog can? And what if the redwood tree does it in a slightly different way? What if the sunset does it in a different way? You know, and then what if you are building relationships with all of the beings that live around your house? You know, you're spending time sitting regularly in the same spot every day and getting to know the three young juncos that have these cute little pointy heads, and you're starting to know them as individuals. Are those little immature songbirds, are they not part of your extended cognition? And isn't that changing you a little at a time? You know, I had this one elder who I worked with for quite a few years before he passed away, who talked to me about, you know, in his culture, the belief was that the creator made the animals so that the animals could teach the human beings how to be human. And that really struck me. And he was talking to a group of trackers back in the 1990s, asking them why they tracked. And they all answered, and he was completely unsatisfied with their answer because they were all talking about, you know, sort of vocational application of tracking skills and, you know, I want to do wildlife studies and this and that, you know. And he kind of just shook his head and he said, nope, the reason you track is because your spirit knows that the more time you spend building a relationship with an animal so you can track it, the more that animal is becoming part of your mind, and you're beginning to see the world through that animal's eyes and senses. And therefore you're learning to care for the things that that animal needs. And you're, with each animal that you add, you inherit or inhabit more and more and more of your landscape until you become a human being who cares about other things besides themselves. And I have seen that, that's that diversity factor I was talking about earlier, you know, that, you know, when Sarah asked that question, you know, is nature the only place we can emerge the natural mind? And I would say because of, I would almost call them like nutrients of our consciousness, you know, that each of these different species and individuals among the species that we build relationships with, just like our dog or our cat, the more of that we get from nature, the more our mind becomes nature and our heart becomes nature. And you know, there's a longing to inhabit this planet in a deeper and different way where we feel like we belong. And when we feel that, then we really care. And then we really want to help make it better. And I think that every relationship we build with every aspect of the natural world has an effect on our consciousness. I really believe that it's cumulative and that it's synergistic and that it's interwoven and that, you know, these are like a tapestry of ropes and threads of relationships that extend our consciousness way out into the world around us. We become our place.
Is this the connecting legacy part that you're speaking to? What do you mean by legacy?
First of all, I was studying anthropology since 1979 and spent a heck of a lot of time, you know, watching old black and white film reels and reading First Contact, you know, ethnographic work from the San Bushmen and from different hunter-gatherer nomadic people. And then, you know, starting in 2010, I began to visit this one community of San Bushmen in the central Kalahari. And I was really there, you know, one, how can we support them? Because the vision for this little community was we really need to keep our culture alive. We're not doing well when we try to go on the on-ramp to modernity, you know, is kind of what one of the elders told me. You know, it's like, you know, you people, you know, meaning us European visitors, European American visitors, you people seem to have some kind of an immune system thing, you know, where you can go into modern life and you won't crash and burn. But he said, we Bushmen, we don't have that. And so many of the people that he knew in his family, in his friend circles that, you know, tried to go into the modern world, they just crashed and burned. And, you know, this particular community formed and they said, well, we actually feel, you know, our hope for our children is to keep our culture alive. And I said, well, what does that mean to you? And he said, well, you know, it's our language, it's our skills, it's how we gather our food, it's how we raise our children. And then I got interested in that last sentence, how do we raise our children? And, you know, they were modeling it for us because there was multiple generations. There's people in their 90s down to infants, you know, so there was like five generations, six generations in some cases of people all together. And as we moved about, you know, this wild landscape, it wasn't wild to them. It was wild to us, I guess, as visitors. But to them, it was, you know, this was their home for the last, you know, whatever, 50, 100,000 years. The way they raised their children was really fascinating to me. And I saw that this grandmother do this thing with this child that was really inspiring. You know, she, you know, this child came, you know, all excited to the grandmother, and she dropped down really low, got to the child's eye height, and looked in her eyes with this big welcoming smile and kind of held her two hands lightly as she spoke to her. And as this little girl, you know, was telling her grandmother this story, you know, her grandmother immediately was like, well, can you show me, you know, because this little girl was excited about a discovery she made under a bush. And can you show me, you know, and brings her grandmother over, and her grandmother gets down low and asks her all these questions, you know, and she, I can see this mentoring going on is what I'm saying, you know, right before my eyes. But the grandmother is also imitating, you know, the animal that she's describing from the tracks to the little girl, you know, and the little girl's imitating it too, you know, sort of mirror neurons going off, right? So there's all this like nuance and dimensionality happening within the storytelling, within the story catching, how the grandmother's catching the story, how she's asking the questions and encouraging this little girl. I could see so many neurons firing in that little girl. I could see so many ways in which this grandmother was showing incredible nuanced style and skill in mentoring. And so after I'd witnessed that, I spoke to the grandmother and I said, do you mind if I ask you a question about what I was watching you do with that young girl? And she said, no, no, that's fine. Ask me, you know, I'm an open book kind of thing is what the translator said. They're open books. They'll tell you anything you want to know. So I asked her, you know, why did you do that with that girl? Like, what made you think to do that? And she's like, do what? I'm not aware that I did anything. Oh, I said, this is what I saw you do. And I saw you do this imitation thing. I saw you drop down to her height. I saw you looking in her eyes with a big smile, holding her hands in a gentle, welcoming way. I saw you imitating as you were talking about the animal tracks and how the tracks were made. I saw her doing the same. You know, it was like you were modeling, you know, this way of imitation or mimicry as a form of study, really, relationship building. And then she said to me, oh, that. Oh, she said, I didn't even realize I was doing that. But the reason I do that is because that's what my grandmother did with me. This woman was probably in her 80s. Her grandmother has probably been gone for many decades. She was, what, 5, 6, 7, 8 when her grandmother did it with her. It's not like she remembered a playbook. Oh, that's what my grandma did, so I should do that. It was more like she was unconsciously competent in that she was so immersed in incredible mentoring as a child in the context of nature, but also in the context of subsistence in nature. Because this woman, when she was 5 or 6, the Bushmen were still living their traditional ways without roads, without fences, without boundaries. Her natural behavior as a mentor was intrinsically motivated. It was instinctive. It was highly developed because that's how she grew up. And how far does that legacy go back in time? And it's an unconscious legacy. So when we think that, okay, so I grew up with my grandmothers who grew up with their grandmothers, both of them on farms and with fathers and uncles and aunties that hunted and fished and farmed and right gathered mushrooms and wild plants, and go back two more generations and you're going to find grandmothers that were doing the same with their grandkids, you know, and it, that just keeps going back in time. But when we sort of modernize and we say, okay, well, it was nice to live in the proximity of our grandmothers and our aunts and uncles on the farm. Oh, but now we have careers. And so now mom is going to move over here and get married to this man over here. And then they're going to go live in suburbia and they're going to have kids. I'm one of those kids. But we're not living on the farm and we're not surrounded by aunties and uncles anymore. But thankfully, you know, my mom and dad know that they have to work. And instead of putting us in daycare or hiring, you know, nannies, they just bring those grandmothers over to look after us. And those grandmothers now, who are unconsciously competent in that legacy of connecting, they do that with my sister and I as when we're little. You know, if I didn't have them in my life as a boy, that would be a broken legacy, wouldn't it? It's not guaranteed to regenerate. And a lot of people have lost that thread or lost those threads. They're no longer there in their family lines. And I see the vital gift that they are and how much could be mended and healed if we could get that back.
Well, it's almost a legacy of human nature in the way of connecting not just information through the generations, but the actual relationships that people had to nature. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, you could boil it down to that. You know, this idea of the natural mind is human nature, or maybe it's nature in human, nature as human. A person who grows up with that kind of relationship with the natural world, with those kinds of mentoring relationships, those kinds of connected families, they have a very different human nature than modern people who feel disconnected, isolated, lonely, right? Being that we as a human family go back, you know, several hundred thousand years, I imagine most of that time was spent in this kind of mentoring of the natural mind in that connecting legacy. So I think our nervous system is born expecting that kind of welcome, that kind of attending, that kind of intending. I think our nervous system is shaped for that. And when I work with adults who didn't grow up this way, it's so interesting to watch how those old instincts that have been buried in them since birth, that were never tended when they were young because of the way they grew up, how they blossom. It's like there's seeds there that just need watering. And when they start to come out, wow, how that person changes. And, you know, when they move into those attributes, just how stunned they are and grateful they are for the grace of this shift in them, and how they thank me. But, you know, it's not me. I'm the end of the line of a long legacy of connecting mentoring.
What you were just saying about adults reconnecting and experiencing nature again and waking up in this way feels really hopeful, because that's 99.9% of us at this point, right, are not living in the Kalahari connected to nature and with grandparents that are connected to nature, et cetera. And so when you think about this idea of looking forward and of the legacy moving into the next generations and into the future generations, paint a picture of that. What does that look like?
A prognostication. Let me see if I can if I can see that into the future here. Well, since I've had 40 something years of practice, you know, and I have to admit that when I was, you know, just starting out in my 20s, I didn't really totally know how to do this, right? And there was a lot of trial and error, but it was more like, you know, the more I sort of relaxed into my instincts to just trust what was done for me would come out through me, you know, the more effective it became. And then I was able to help loads of young people and, you know, get them into that state. Then the adults in around the 1990s started to say, hey, you're wasting this on my kids. I read Tom Brown books. They have no idea who you are and what you're doing for them, and they don't appreciate it. I do. So can you do that with me? And that was when I first forayed into working with adults. It was probably 1992 or so. You know, and I found, you know, just the obvious thing, you know, children, their neuroplasticity is really, you know, high level, right? They adapt and change very quickly, whereas adults are a little bit trickier. They might be sort of wedded to patterns and habits that are kind of deeply entrenched, so that neuroplasticity is still there, but it's harder to get the ball rolling. So I just realized how difficult it was to work with adults versus children. But I continued, I didn't give up. And I began to realize that I needed to reverse engineer what was done for me. And that was brought to my attention by Ellen Haas, the co-author of Coyote's Guide, because she saw me doing stuff in 1994, 95 with young people at programs that she was shadowing me on. And she's like, how did you know to do that? And just like that Bushman grandmother, I said, what did you see me do? Like, I'm not sure what you're talking about. And then she kind of reconstructed a moment that I had with this young man. And I said, oh, that, right. She said, well, why did you think to do that? I never would have thought to do that. And I said to her, well, actually, I didn't think to do it. It just came to me. I just knew to do it. I don't know how to explain it. It was like what Tom did with me when I was that age. So it's that default. So what Ellen insisted on was, we need to write a book about this. We need to get this in the hands of teachers and parents and aunts and uncles and grandparents so they can do this for their children. And that was Coyote's Guide. And it took us 14 years to write it, but it was the bulk of the effort in the first 10 years was Ellen following me around and reverse engineering and bringing out of me what was unconsciously competent to make it visible to me. And then therefore, I'm now able to make it visible to others. And we started to see, how you do it with four-year-olds is different from how you're going to do it with a nine-year-old versus, and if that, four-year-old becomes a nine-year-old who's been on this nature journey the whole time, they're going to have really different needs than a nine-year-old who's just entering nature connection for the first time. So there's like layers of understanding that you have to have as the mentor. There's, where is that child on their profile journey? Are they a beginner? Are they motivated, self-motivated? Are they focused? Are they now getting to that place of embodied? So these are the first four stages. So we had to break it down into the stages of learning and experience in connection. Then there's the challenge of how many subject areas exist in the natural world. This little girl over here is really drawn to studying the little mammals. She loves the little mammals. This boy over here, he's super interested in the fish. And this one over here, he just wants to sit by the fire and play with different fuels and see how they burn. Like these kids, it's like nature is like, oh my God, there's like 2,000 subjects. And they all seem to be interested in different subjects. So we had to map out the possible subject pathways, experience pathways. We had to map out the developmental journey and how they changed as they went and how their needs changed. And then we had to account for different learning styles. And when we put it all together, we created something called the 512 map, which, sort of models as many possibilities as we could come up with. So we came up with 512 categories that are organized into patterns of eight. So there's eight what we call petals or shields of information, experience, and then they help a person, you track a person as they go deeper and deeper on, crossing these developmental lines on their journey. And we did that so that we could actually, develop a database that could help track a person on that journey. And because mentoring doesn't scale very easily, because it might take 5-6 years of mentoring before someone becomes a natural mentor and begins to pass this legacy forward in their own life. And you can kind of, you can't work with that many people at once. You can't track all those details for more than a handful of individuals if you're a mentor. But if we're assisted by technology and we're assisted with learning pathways, and we're assisted in developing facilitators, we can scale that. And the idea being that we might be scaling it in a virtual village like our project Living Connection First, which is, constantly evolving towards this outcome. But our hope is that they will then localize what they're learning with their own families, with their own programs. And, that's been happening for the last 25, 30 years. And now there's projects in Australia, New Zealand, all over the Europe and the UK and North America and, India. And it is catching on. So what might the future look like? I mean, if I had my druthers, then we would basically pull together a lot of these Deep Nature Connection mentors from the network in the world and form a bigger and stronger team and begin to create, you know, leveraged force multipliers, you know, using AI, using the digital map of the sphere of what it would be like to grow up in a really deeply connected village, and then encourage people to do it locally and, you know, help monitor their progress and help support them as they're supporting others and, you know, just get better at that. You know, that's where I see it going, because I will always mentor one-on-one. I always have a handful of apprentices that I'm working with because I have to. It's like intrinsically my responsibility. I just feel that. So I always have a handful of people I'm working with. But I really want this to help many, many more people who, as you know, retired McKinsey consultant Peter Slenska said, you know, mentoring is not scalable. And I said, well, I think it is scalable. He says, why do you think that? And I said, well, because, you know, I was mentored by Tom and, you know, he mentored me to that depth, but I turned around and mentored hundreds. He says, okay, well, it is scalable at that level. You know, I'll give you that, John. He says, but what about the 10 million people on the planet who know right now that they want mentoring like this? How do you help them? And I'm like, oh, I got you. Right. In that sense, it's not scalable. But I think with, you know, the evolution of the 512 map and the team that's coming together around it, we have a shot at scaling. And it's a work in progress. We've been working on this since 2007, getting to this point. You know, how will it look going forward? That was my dream of it going forward. What you asked me, Aiden, that, you know, that's what I see, you know, a network of networks that's being supported by a database that's tracking these characteristics and helping people always know what the next breadcrumb is without the need for the mentor to be right there all the time with them.
Wow, John, thank you. That is a beautiful vision. And, you know, Aiden and I are right here with you, standing beside you, and, you know, many others that also have seen a similar possibility and hope for the future. So thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for this. This is super inspiring. And I think it is a nice set of homework for everybody who's inspired to be a part of this going forward as well. And if you haven't raised your hand to let us know that you want to be part of that, you know where to find us. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Grandfather told Tom, if there's only one thing that I could teach a person, it would be have them go find a place to sit every day. So if you really want to start, at least go sit in your backyard every day in the same spot and get to know all the pointy-headed juncos around you. That's where it begins. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Aiden and Sarah.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. You can find everything related to the podcast and our current offerings at trackingconnections.net. We'll see you next time.